One, two, three.
The following audio exclusive features the uncut interview with CEO of the Ms. Foundation for Women, Teresa Junger. She was featured in our episode, Gender Justice Requires More Than Money, Say the Feminists Taking on Philanthropy During COVID.
Many social ills were made more visible and worse by the COVID-19 epidemic. Among those, racial, gender, and class inequities. At the same time, the very rich got richer and demands for justice got louder. And some individuals gave away record-breaking amounts of money through private philanthropy. Just this month, 286 nonprofits received huge grants from Mackenzie Scott, ex-wife of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos. This summer's drop, Scott's third in a year, was worth almost $2.75 billion with a B. What's all that private funding do? How does it change the field of philanthropy in general? And how does it change the landscape for social justice? This week, we'll talk with one of the very few African-American women at the head of a long-standing public foundation, Teresa Junger. She is president and CEO of the Ms. Foundation, which last year released a report showcasing the drastic need to hold philanthropy accountable to communities and movements and the changes they seek. Teresa Junger is also a participant in the White House Gender Policy Council. Teresa, I'm sure that in lots of ways you share these dire sense of the situation that we're in. But how would you describe the sort of parameters of this moment?
This moment is actually no different than any other moment yesterday or any other moment in 2019 or 2014 or 2008. What this moment is a flashlight on all of the societal ills and the trickle-down effect that they have had on women and their families throughout the United States and across the globe.
So elaborate on that. I mean, you're not saying that COVID-19 didn't happen.
No. But I think what happened, I mean, I've been with the Ms. Foundation for 7 years and had been in social justice work for about 20 years before that. Women were, we were seeing health disparities years and years and years and years ago. We were seeing issues around low wage work years and years and years ago. We were seeing sexual abuse and violence against women years ago. We were seeing a lack of childcare years ago. This is what we are seeing today has been going on in this country, particularly for hundreds of years. Colonialism, white supremacy has been going on in this country for hundreds of years. And we are just seeing, because nobody could do anything over COVID. So we were seeing every single day the disruption of what these factors were having and how those factors were having them on the lives of women and girls and folks and gender nonconforming folks throughout this country.
That brings us to the op-ed that you wrote with Joy Anderson, the president and founder of the Criterion Institute, where you talked about this moment as maybe not new, but as a moment of opportunity. And you began that by imagining a world where we took the temperature of our economy differently. How?
Well, I think, you know, we have continued to assume that success in this country is about how the markets look. And those markets were developed by white men hundreds of years ago. They were not developed in line with women, women and girls of color, trans folks, gender nonconforming folks, LGBT folks. None of those folks were in the conversation. Women in general were not in the conversation. So why are we going back to the same systems that have continued to fail over half of our society? And so this is an opportunity. You know, when Joy and I started talking about this, I said, we can get really down in the dumps. Most of us haven't seen too many people in 18 months. Or we can look at this as a true, you know, in the Chinese version of yin and yang, how do we see this as an opportunity to actually start analyzing the systems? And maybe we shouldn't just assume that finance and capitalism are the only ways to measure success in our society.
Shock horror, not just finance and capitalism. You also make the point, which I did find incredibly discouraging, that there's been a lot of talk about gender disparities, a lot of analysis, a lot of evidence of the problem, and yet that has not been taken on board as we design responses, solutions. Talk about what you've seen and what you've not seen in this moment.
Well, I think one of the things we have to keep in mind is that the positions that hold power in this country are still predominantly white male. And so the idea of asking them to give up some avenue of power and disperse that power and actually find other people's experiences relevant to formulating decisions means that they have to take risk. It does not mean they can just rest back on their laurels. So we got to where we are because nobody was listening to those most directly affected. And what we are seeing right now, I think under the current administration, is possibly a chance for us to rethink some things, to actually have open conversations about how we're recentering a conversation, whether that's around research, whether that's around tax reform, whether that's around healthcare reform, whether that's around minimum wage or redefining infrastructure. We are actually seeing a conversation that says, maybe it's not just about white men, but maybe we actually need to value what's happening in other places. And one of the things that Joy and I imagine in the front part of our op-ed is we actually say, what would it look like if we placed value on those that are providing services and holding the solutions in our communities and not just ask them to come to Washington or to go to a state capitol and testify, but paid them for their services and values that they are bringing to the table, listen to them, understand that change is not going to happen in one term or two terms. We're talking about generational change that needs to happen in this country. And so what we're actually leaning back on and positioning the conversation around is for us to actually stop thinking that what we have been doing is the answer to what we need to do moving forward.
So what would that look like? I mean, you are there on the White House Gender Policy Council. There's been discussion of universal preschool, childcare, investing in all of these kinds of policies, including senior care and so on, but very little flesh on the bones, very few bits of data. And in an op-ed just recently in the New York Times, Bryce Covert, who writes about these things, says many of the Biden plans are out of date.
So here's one of the things. One of the things we should note is the Gender Policy Council is the White House's attempt to look inside and to align the gender assessment analysis with a race lens and disability lens from inside. It's looking at both a global as well as a domestic alignment for what the administration might want to be doing. And so I'm not sitting on the council, I'm sitting with the council to be part of a conversation that they need to have. And we're looking at that from a multitude of spaces and places. They are actually doing a listening analysis of what needs to happen. They are looking at research and data that's being collected across all different kinds of departments and are asking folks, what do you think needs to be collected? How do we recenter the information? How do we provide consistency in what we're doing? How do we break down that data? And I would say that so many of the Biden administration policies or proposed policies may be a little outdated, but they're further than we have been in a long time. I mean, we actually have in this country right now a child care tax credit that allows for families to get tax credit. We have, for the first time, nonprofits can apply for payroll tax credits. We have a conversation going on, maybe stagnated now, about the determination of what infrastructure looks like. We're having real conversations about what a care economy looks like, not just from the perspective of childcare, but what it looks like to care for our elderly community members.
And you have confidence that this conversation is headed towards the kind of systemic change that you have in mind? Because to a lot of us on the outside, it still looks super temporary and a little bit moderate in tone.
Yeah. I mean, do I have confidence that this is going to get, I think here's what I have confidence in. We're having a conversation that we have not legitimately had before. And sometimes it's just asking the question that gets everybody uncomfortable. So do I believe in this one term with a defunct Senate that we're going to get these policies passed? Maybe not. Do I think that state legislatures have an opportunity to implement some of these pieces and we can recreate what that looks like? Possibly. But I'm also absolutely disheartened that we can't get a voting rights bill through. And I'm absolutely disheartened that, you know, we are looking at spending trillions of dollars on infrastructure reform, and we can't decide on what that should look like. And we only want to go back to what it has been. It's roads and trains and planes, it's bridges, but we actually need to have a real conversation. What does it take to live in our country, to thrive? Why do we always talk about minimums from the basement? Why don't we talk about it from the midpoint? So I will say, I don't know that I'm blindly optimistic. There are no rose-colored glasses, but I feel like we're having a legitimate conversation where people are not ignoring.
Well, that takes us to movements. And you wouldn't have been all these years in philanthropy and social justice if you felt that change happened overnight or with one administration.
That's right.
So let's talk about that. You mentioned trillions. Trillions of dollars are moving at this moment. And we've seen something like $9 billion move from just one source, Mackenzie Scott, in the last 12 months.
Yeah.
On the one hand, this is fantastic. Going to social justice, responding to the demands of groups like the Movement for Black Lives. But you were part of a large group of philanthropists from public philanthropies, public foundations, who wrote a letter to philanthropy as a field, raising some concerns. You said, on the one hand, this is great, but it wouldn't be great if we do this transfer of money wrong, if we didn't do it right. So can you lay out your concerns about this while, of course, it's fantastic to see money shifting?
Well, I think one of the things we need to lift up is that public foundations like the Ms. Foundation raise our dollars. We are committed and responsible to the grassroots that we are serving towards the missions that we are trying to achieve. When we see gifts like Mackenzie Scott, which are based in trust. She is making those gifts with no strings attached for a limited period of time and saying to nonprofit groups on the ground doing this work, you spend this money how you see fit. But what we have to understand is that many, many nonprofits, social justice movements in this country are completely underfunded. And instead of also, you know, sometimes people feel like they have to do it their way. We actually know public philanthropy actually knows how to service our communities. And we have actually been formulating deep relationship with movement structures for a long time. So that letter that we wrote in conjunction with what I consider some of the best thinkers in public philanthropy was really about questioning the fact that why do we always need to start something new and make things hard? Why don't we learn and listen to those who have been moving money to the field, those who have a social responsibility to have an impact, and that we are listening to the grassroots? I mean, when you're talking about the amount of money that Mackenzie Scott is moving, there are also hundreds of thousands of nonprofits in this country, and many of them are being that have budgets under $500,000 and are servicing their communities and were called on during COVID to do just that.
Let me ask you to just really underscore the difference between private philanthropy and public. And I care because it models a little bit the reality in public media. We raise our own money. We're accountable to our audience versus somebody who has a bunch of bucks and puts on a TV show or a new shiny object in the media stratosphere, a new app or so forth.
Exactly. So you totally understand this. We are accountable to the communities that we serve. We are accountable to being explicit and about what we are trying to do and how we are trying to do it. Many public foundations are also accountable to deep relationship. We don't just get to, on a whim, change our minds about what we want to do, how we want to do it, and the impact we want to have. And we are looking at generational change. We're not looking for day-to-day wins that we can just check off on a piece of paper. Private philanthropy, on the other side of it, has regulations about they have to spend 5% of whatever dollars they have. They have to give it away. 5% of a million, a billion, 16 million is a lot of money, but why should they be sitting on the other 95% that they're not spending? Where many public foundations have small, if we have endowments, we have smaller endowments. We are spending above and beyond 5%. Most of us are at 7% or 10%. We are raising on an annual basis the dollars we want to move to the field. We are performing an education to those that are in conversation with us. Many public foundations, including women's foundations in this country, are about building collective power, and we're having open and honest conversations about that.
So I'm hearing a little bit of an echo of the debate that has happened under neoliberalism about private versus public policy and government and programs. And those who advocate for the private sector say we move more quickly, we're more efficient, we're more metric oriented, we care about outcomes, we don't have such a slow process. They might listen to this and say, is this sour grapes from people who've been in foundation world for years and haven't shifted things enough? Otherwise, we wouldn't be in this mess.
Well, I think it's a great question. And if people who, if those who are in the private field feel like they are doing it better, then they should be in partnership with philanthropy, particularly public philanthropy, about how to do it. This is not about measuring year on year on year. This is about having a long-term impact on the community and the world that we are trying to create. And at the Ms. Foundation for Women, we are trying to create a safe and just world where power and possibility are not limited. We believe that democracy, that inclusion and equity are the cornerstone of a true democracy. We are explicit about what we are trying to do. And I would say in our letter, we were clear. We are moving dollars to the field. And in fact, many organizations in this country would not be operating today through this pandemic had it not been for the public foundations that are out there doing the work. We are out there having the really tough conversations about a strategy for long-term impact. And we're not doing it because you wrote the best proposal. We're not doing it because you've told us how many people you served. We're doing it because we know, and at the Ms. Foundation, we trust that women have the answers to help and heal their communities. They need the resources to do that, and they need the time, rather than dancing on the, you know, top of a needle or whatever it is.
I really recommend people to check out the open letter to philanthropy that we're talking about here, because it goes into clear and poignant detail about the pros and cons of the kind of private philanthropy model that we're seeing in this moment. And you talk about the stresses on organizations, on foundations, to try to inform people who are new to the field when they really could be just helping the field as it exists with the relationships that are already built. So we will post that on our website. I want to come to the research that you actually did a year ago, speaking to movement groups about the form of accountability that they're seeking and the stresses that they're feeling. Because a lot of people think more money is good, period. Not always the case.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that people have to understand is money has to be consistent. And in our new report that we put out last year called Pocket Change, How Women and Girls of Color Are Doing More with Less, we actually did an analysis of what is happening in the field. And what we heard from those who are doing work is more times than not, there's always this, you know, it's like voter fraud in some ways. There's always this assumption that the dead person is voting, right? There's always this assumption that nonprofits led by women of color, you know, are like stealing money from the top of the game. They are not. And what we found was philanthropy needs to be specific. They need to name what they are doing. They need to track what they are doing, and then they need to increase the amounts of money. So one of the things that's both consistent with the report and with the letter is this idea that we need to fund organizations over time, not on a year-to-year basis, but on a multi-year basis, because what we see is the stress of having to do that draws the attention away from getting the outcomes on a day-to-day basis that we need to see in our communities.
You mentioned voting, and I have to say, I'm curious about this word equity. We have not yet moved to the place where we're talking about voting equity. We still talk about rights, voting rights. What happened to the word rights in the context of gender and race and civil justice?
My understanding and my belief is that rights is something that is written down in a document. Equity is a philosophy of leveling out the playing field, addressing systemic change, and making that happen. Rights are policies. Equity is about systemic change. And that's what we are looking at. We are looking at what does gender equity look like? What does racial equity look like? How do we have open and honest conversations about them? Because you can put rights on the books and they don't get actually felt in the community. But equity is a philosophy. It is a strategy. It is an indoctrination into policy change and systemic change that needs to happen.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it. Finally, this word gender, in fact, the word women, we wouldn't talk about men the way that we talk about women very often, as one enormous category. And in this moment, it seems as if there are some women who are indeed experiencing the she session. A lot of women, single heads of households, professionals, leaving work to look after kids, suffering the consequences of that gap in their professional career. But there are a lot of women who are not leaving the workforce, who never did during this pandemic. How do you serve all of these interests at the Ms. Foundation?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that we say at the Ms. Foundation is women are not monolithic and gender is not binary. And so if we can at least acknowledge those things, then we get to a whole different conversation.
By which we mean gender, there's more than two.
There's more than two, right? Gender nonconforming, trans folks, two-spirited folks, we believe all of them are encompassed in the conversation. And in fact, we cannot get to full equity for women until we have equity across the board. And we have real conversations about what that looks like and what that means. And that's part of our conversation. We're starting the conversation at the Ms. Foundation by centering women and girls of color as our starting point. And we believe that in the pool of inequality, if we can drop one stone over one thing, it's going to be women and girls of color. And the rippling effects will come across so many different folks who are in that pool of inequality, whether it's with disabilities, whether it's trans, whether it's men, you know, it can be anybody, but we're going to start there as a point because it changes the conversation. So much of our conversations have centered around white males. And even when you move women into that conversation, it has traditionally not been about women and girls of color, has not been about Black women and girls. And how do we change what's happening in our society? We have to address the centering conversation that we're looking to have an impact on. We can't start at the top of the hill and expect everybody to be okay because they got to the top of the hill.
We know trickle down doesn't work. Trickle up works way better. We could talk for ages. Thank you so much for your work. We typically end these conversations with a question about what it is that gives you not just confidence, but a taste that these enormous changes that we're talking about are possible. We've talked for years about another world is possible. Was there ever a moment in your life or an interaction or a person in whose company you felt it was palpable?
Wow, that's such a great question. And I have to tell you, in this role, as well as in state government, which is where I was before I was with Ms., every day I interact and engage with folks that I believe in a future that is common. And, you know, at my core, Laura, I am a Girl Scout. I believe in making the world a better place. Everything I am doing is about making the world a better place, leaving this world better than I found it. And I come across people every day who believe that. And many of our grantee partners who have been doing this work year after year after year are looking at this moment in time and recognizing it is different. 7 years ago, we would not even acknowledge a conversation about race, even though we had a Black president. And today we are in the midst of conversations about race, gender, class, equity in these conversations. And I have to say, that allows me to think that also the next generation of young people understand what that world could look like. And they're willing to ask the questions about it.
Well, Girl Scout that you are, thank you so much. That has left us on a very good, positive note. And we should point out to people that the great thing about public philanthropy and public foundations is the public can actually contribute to them. That's just right. Saying. Teresa Younger, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.